Right, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Welcome, thank you all for delaying until 1:30 this afternoon, and welcome to our guests. It's always great to have you here in our Capitol. Some of you have seen earlier this week, so it's nice to have you back again. We are going to go out of order, so we are going to start by opening up a public hearing on HJR 201A. Yeah, will you give us a summary, and we'll bring up the two representatives, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. HJR 201A proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to be referred to the voters, allowing municipalities such as counties, cities, or towns to use certain bonded indebtedness to finance capital costs of affordable housing. It directs jurisdictions authorizing bonded indebtedness to provide annual audits and public reporting on the expenditures of proceeds. Specifies requirements for the measure referred to voters to ascribe affordable housing for the purposes above, and requires the principal amount of indebtedness for a jurisdiction to not exceed 0.5% of the real market value of all property in the jurisdiction. The fiscal impact has been issued, and there is no revenue impact, no sub-referrals. This one's ready to go.
Great. So, representatives, welcome.
Hi, thank you, Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I represent House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. More importantly for this role, this bill here, or resolution, I chair the Human Services and Housing Committee, and have really in that capacity been working with my colleagues on the committee to figure out how to get out of the housing crisis. So we've done a number of things, often in partnership with your committee. It's been a pleasure. And one of the things that has come up is as we try to get more creative with financing and look at bonding packages, that the Constitution that was written over 100 years ago put a lot of restrictions in place on bonding for capital construction. Originally, a lot of what is in the Constitution was really meant for things like firehouses that are publicly owned. So when it comes to affordable housing, there are restrictions that are currently in the Constitution. For instance, there needs to be public ownership of it. That really limits the way that we can encourage private enterprise to help us. And we know there's not enough money in the public sector to try to meet the need of affordable housing. We really need to do everything we can to activate the private sector. So this idea came forward to us that we should send a ballot, a referral to the ballot in November 2018 to amend the Constitution to make bonding for affordable housing more flexible. So we had, I'm just going to speak to the process more than the content. We thoroughly vetted this. We focused on this in our September hearings, our November hearings, and our January hearings. And during that time, I asked for two volunteers from our Human Services Committee to step forward and get into the weeds on this with the stakeholders. And Representative Nierman and Representative Meek, who I'm hoping can show up here, worked on that and really dug into the weeds. And I think people may know that Representative Nierman in particular is really a watchdog for process, having good process and making sure that things are thoroughly vetted, and he certainly carried that accountability lens to this particular to this resolution. Mark Meek has been involved in housing efforts for a long time as a realtor, and so really brought the lens of how do we get a bigger supply out there, and this combination has resulted in a fantastic package that was unanimously passed by our committee as well as by the full House. And so I have every confidence that we've done what we need to do to make sure that we've lifted the restrictions so that we can really have the private market step in and have less shackles in them as they try to help us out with the housing crisis. So I actually have to leave. I have two bills in the next committee, but I just want to really thank Representative Nierman and Representative Meek, as well as all the stakeholders, the bond attorneys, the bond counsel. There have been so many eyes that have looked at this. So I am very confident that we've gotten it right, and we have full support from the House as it comes over here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mike Nierman from House District 23, which I describe as I'm the representative from 99W, from Highway 99W. So thanks to Chair Kenny-Geyer. She got out before I could thank her for her kind words there. One of the things, the Oregon Constitution forbids the public ownership in any kind of capital construction project. Ironically, except if it's a port, And I suggested, why don't we do affordable housing projects and just call them ports, and just it's good. We don't have to touch the Constitution then. That didn't go over. But anyway, it's a fix. She talked about private sector money, and when I hear private sector, I think Intel and Nike and things like that. And really, part of the private sector is also nonprofits, and that's where I'm hoping to see some of the creativity to use this new flexibility will come in. And so I'm not the biggest expert on the issues surrounding this. I think there's people behind me that will that are bigger experts than I am, but I would be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Neerman? Seeing none.
Good,
great. Thank you very much. So I'm torn in looking for guidance. We have a lot to get through today, and the plan is to move this bill today. So if we move through the rest of this, can we do it relatively quickly so we can get to House Bill 4009 and do it all intact? Are you okay with us finishing this one and then going on to 4009 instead of starting and stopping? I want to make sure that everybody's schedule is accommodated. Okay. Excellent. All right. So let's move on then. Let's have Harvey Rogers, Allison McIntosh, and Aaron Doyle. And Representative Meek.
On cue.
We're
Good afternoon. I think I'll start this. I just walked in, so pardon me, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Meek, representative for House District 40, which is Oregon City, Gladstone, Johnson City, Jennings Lodge, and unincorporated Clackamas County. I can't leave anybody out or they get upset about that. But very happy to be here with you this afternoon to testify in support of House Joint Resolution 201. I know that all of us here recognize that we continue to face a housing crisis across our entire state. And I see the impacts of this crisis every single day as both a legislator and as a realtor. I'm actually a property manager, and I know I have folks calling me all the time to see, do you have something available that I could rent? And then in some cases I may have something, and I ask them what their affordability level is, and invariably I'm $400 or $500 above what they can afford. And there is just not a lot of inventory out there for folks to rent. And I believe that this issue needs to be addressed at every level, including locally. And to do that, we need to have every tool available, which includes, hopefully, this joint resolution. Right now, local governments can seek voter approval for general obligation bonds to build more affordable housing, but those local governments cannot take full advantage of those GO bonds due to outdated restrictions in the Oregon Constitution, which limit their ability to pair these bonds with common financing tools, such as low-income housing tax credits. What HJR 201 will do is give local governments more flexibility when their voters approve of general obligation bonds for affordable housing. It will do this by allowing localities to leverage private resources as well as partner with nonprofit housing developers in order to build more affordable housing. I am glad to see that the House passed this bill unanimously, and very proud of the collaborative bipartisan work that has taken place with this resolution. Ultimately, we need to find more ways to increase the supply of affordable housing, and I believe that this resolution will help us to do that. I urge your support and adoption of HJR 201, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Meek? Thank you, and you're welcome to stay, or you are welcome to go about your other duties as needed.
I'm over supposed to be Ways and Means right now.
All right.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Senator.
You.
Thank you much, committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser,
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harvey Rogers. I'm a lawyer in private practice with the firm of Hawkins, Delafield, and Wood. We're privileged to represent the majority of borrowing governments in the state of Oregon, including Oregon Housing and Community Services Department and the Department of General Services and the City of Portland and a bunch of others. We're very lucky. I'm here today representing the City of Portland. I have done this sort of work for more than 40 years. I'm fascinated by it, and I can drone on endlessly about it. But since you're in a hurry, I'm going to try and skip through my presentation quickly. And if I don't cover something you want to hear more about, please let me know.
We will never punish you for efficiency.
All right. And much of this has been covered by the excellent testimony of the other legislators who preceded me. Oregon has Oregon local governments. This is a constitutional amendment that benefits Oregon local governments, not the state, can issue general obligation bonds with voter approval. And if the voters approve it, they can levy a tax to pay the bonds. So it's a unique financing mechanism, takes voter approval, comes with the authority to pay the bonds back. The Oregon Constitution, since its beginning, has had a prohibition on lending of credit or raising money for artificial entities, partnerships, corporations, yada, yada. It's a fuzzy old provision. Nobody knows for sure exactly what it means. But more than 100 years ago, a court decided it meant a city couldn't issue bonds to help a railroad. When local governments borrow money in large amounts, they have to obtain what's called the opinion of nationally recognized bond counsel. That's what my firm does. That's what I've done for the last 40 years. We can only give that opinion if we are confident that no reasonable judge would disagree with us. Since 100 years ago, some judge said you can't finance private railroads, we can't give opinions on general obligation bonds that have significant private involvement. These days, affordable housing projects are very difficult to stick together, and folks have developed wonderful techniques and programs to help affordable housing, including low-income housing tax credits. That's a very significant addition to the financing of almost any low-income rental project. And you can only take advantage of that by involving private entities. If this amendment is not passed, local governments could still issue general obligation bonds to finance housing, but they couldn't leverage that money or provide for other private involvement. That's really all I have to say. I would be happy to try and answer questions.
Thank you. Well, let's finish the panel first, and then we'll come back to questions if there are any.
Great. Thank you, Chair Gelser. Members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance in strong support of HJR 201. I want to say thank you to Representative Nierman, Representative Meek, and Representative Kenny Geyer. They put together a work group and had Harvey talk them through all manner of things and really studied the measure in depth and really appreciate their time and attention to detail. The Oregon Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 80 organizations from all parts of the state, including local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and organizations working to meet basic needs. We believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable place to call home, and today we simply don't have enough affordable homes for people who need them. As you all know, during the last school year, there were over 22,000 school children in grades K through 12 that experienced homelessness. We have many tools at our disposal to address our affordable housing issues, and HJR 201 seeks to add flexibility for bonds issued by local jurisdictions for the purposes of building more affordable homes. As other panelists have explained, local jurisdictions can, in fact, issue bonds for affordable housing. And last year, or in 2016, the city of Portland did issue general obligation bonds to build more affordable homes. As Harvey explained, when they do that, they have to own and control the housing that is built with it, and they can't partner with private developers or nonprofit housing providers to own that housing. And they also can't blend any other financing tools. So the number of units that they can build is limited to the amount of bond dollars. They can't leverage federal tax credits. With this additional flexibility, we believe we could build substantially more affordable housing, and perhaps more importantly, smaller local jurisdictions without dedicated housing staff could also consider a bond as a potential way to develop more needed homes in their communities. So HJR 201 would refer to voters an exemption to this lending of credit prohibition. And I will say the House also included a requirement for audits and reporting as a safeguard to make sure that we are spending public dollars wisely. We know that our local, state, and federal government must all work together to solve our housing crisis and create more affordable homes, and we believe that HJR 201 is a modest change to the Constitution that would address a pressing problem. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As you may know, the League represents all 241 cities across the state, and many of our communities have been asking advice from the League about what tools they have to help increase the amount of affordable and workforce housing that are located in their communities. There are very few ways that cities can provide financial assistance to affordable housing development. Most of those tools leverage our property tax revenue to try and reduce the long-term cost of owning and operating affordable housing developments, but those cuts can have impacts on other services. HJR 201 will provide another means to leverage city resources to support the development of affordable units without putting an undue burden on other services provided at the local government level. Allowing the local government to have a conversation with its citizens about a different type of investment in affordable housing can allow us to meet the needs of all those in our community. In addition, this will allow us to help our nonprofit and affordable housing developer partners in leveraging other sources of funding that we currently cannot help them with. I strongly believe that this puts our public bonding towards another public purpose, which is affordable housing, which is a need that a number of our cities have found is lacking, and they don't know how to address it effectively. For these reasons, we ask for your support in passing HJR 201. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Are there any questions for this panel? No. Great. Thank you very much. All right. Next, we've got Peggy Lynch. And is there anybody else that wants to be heard on HJR 201A?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Chair is in Corvallis, and I happen to live just outside of Corvallis. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Our testimony to the House Human Services and Housing Committee is exhibit number 4 in your under the bill. So I won't read the whole thing. I just really want to say what they said, basically, to make it really clear. What's important and what was important to the League is the fact that local voters in their local jurisdictions have the opportunity to make this decision. The second part about it that was important to us is that local governments can then have the ability to place fiscal sideboards to assure good use of the public's money, as they're, because this is allowing private access to the public's money, and that was really important. So having the opportunity for local governments to do this and local voters to have that conversation, I think, is really positive, and we certainly do need more affordable housing in Oregon. Be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Lynch? Seeing none,
thank you
very much. Last chance, anybody else want to be heard on HJR 201? No, all right, I'm gonna close the public hearing on HJR 201A and open a work session on HJR 201A. Senator Knope.
Madam Chair, I move HJR 201A to the floor be adopted recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Knope moves HJR 201A to the floor with a be adopted recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion? I'll just say this is really great work. I think one of the important pieces of legislation that will come out of this session and the stakeholder efforts on this were just phenomenal. And the process on this getting to go to yet another committee, that's why I wanted to get it out on its way today so we can get it moved on.
Yes. And I'd like to say that the advocates for this, including Representative Alyssa Kenegar, really had educated us ahead of time,
yeah,
before it even got here. So I think, at least from my perspective, I know a whole lot about it.
Very, very well done, very thorough. All right, Senator Knope. Oh, we already had the discussion. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and heads over to Senate Rules. I'll close the work session on HJR 201. Let's quickly do the two work sessions from the hearings we had last week, because that will take just a second. I will open up a work session on HB 4014. And colleagues, this is the one that removes the requirement of volunteer service for foster children. And Senator Knope.
Which one are we on?
We are on House Bill 4014.
4014? Madam Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I move HB 4014 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 4014 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Wagner, would you carry this one to the floor, please?
Be happy to, Madam Chair.
All right. Close the work session on House Bill 4014. Open work session on House Bill 4134. This is the bill that removes the discriminatory restrictions from the deeds. That was a pretty moving hearing we had last week.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move HB 3134 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
4134.
What did I say?
31.
Wonderful. So we need the dyslexia bill back. HB 4134A with a due pass recommendation. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 4134A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I don't have an objection, but I wasn't here during the last meeting. I'd like to have time to review that. So I've just got to say,
please do entrust us when we tell you you're going to be voting yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you'd like to, if you'd like a few minutes, we can hold this and do the vote at the end, if that would be.
Sure.
Why don't we do that? So I'm going to temporarily close the work session on.
Great. Thank you.
Do we have to rescind the motion?
Or you could recess it. Just recess.
Okay. I'm going to recess the work session on House Bill 4134A. And open up a public hearing, and don't let me forget to come back to that bill later. Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4009A.
You would like a summary, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we would love a summary, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4009A allows the reinstatement of the termination of parental rights in specific circumstances. It specifies that the Department of Human Services or the ward may file a motion to reinstate the parental rights of a former parent if the ward has not been adopted or does not have a legal parent. It has been at least 18 months since the termination of parental rights or 6 months since affirmation of the judgment by an appellate court. And the ward is at least 12 years old, or good cause exists when the ward is under 12. Specifies the process for initiating reinstatement, requires DHS to give notice to the ward if former parent notifies DHS of the desire to reinstate parental rights and eligibility exists. Requires showing by clear and convincing evidence that the former parent is fit, wishes to have parental rights reinstated, and that the reinstatement is in the ward's best interest. Specifies that if the ward is over 14 years of age, the ward must consent to reinstatement. Provides a 6 month period following the reinstatement in which the ward remains of the court, and requires a permanency hearing within 60 days of reinstating the parental rights. There is one amendment which removes the ability for the ward to file a motion to reinstate the parental rights of the former parent, and it prohibits DHS from filing a motion to reinstate the parental rights of the former parent who has a pending criminal charge or has been convicted of a person felony or a Class A misdemeanor, and the ward was the victim of the person felony or the Class A misdemeanor. We do not yet have the revenue impact statements or the fiscal impact statements.
All right. Representative Sanchez.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the state representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. This bill concept was brought to me by Youth Rights Justice and a bunch of other folks anyway, but it was one of the things that, you know, needless to say, a very, very important issue in my opinion. As we all know, our child welfare system is struggling right now. We have some difficult things happening, and one of the biggest things is a place for kiddos to be. The fact that our kiddos are in long-term placements is not the best option for many, many youth, that they move from foster home to foster home, and in particular that happens with a lot of teenagers. This bill addresses the issue of a situation that is sometimes rare, but when a child has the opportunity and option to go home, then a parent has taken care of the issues that caused that termination in the first place. It simply creates a path for that child to be able to go home. There's a lot of details to it. I know you also have an amendment, another amendment coming. We're hoping to, you know, look at lots of different ways to make this happen. But I feel like we got a lot of people on board for this conversation, a lot of agreement on the path that we can use to move forward. It's, again, just another option to help us mitigate some of the issues in our child welfare system, create that pathway for kids to go home. Over the years that I've worked in with child welfare, over and over, it's teenagers who feel like this is just isn't working for me, and I shouldn't just go to another home. I want to go home. My mom's clean and sober now, or my, you know, dad's out of prison now. Whatever it is, the children should be able to go home to the best place that where someone loves them the most, if that's what they want to do. And DHS gets to help make that decision, of course, and the child gets to initiate that process as well. So I think it's an important bill. I think it's something we've needed to do for a minute. So.
Thank you very much. And if it's okay, can we have Ms. Sophia go first and kind of describe what that other amendment is as well, just to make sure. So there is another amendment that is coming later. Just wanted to make sure that everybody had this before Tuesday, because I would really like to move this bill to the floor, and I didn't want to bring it to you on the same day that we voted on it.
So I'm going to go ahead and pull that up. I'll go ahead and put my name on the record. So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you so much, sir. My name is Mary Sophia. I'm the legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and Youth Rights and Justice came to Representative Sanchez many months ago to try to essentially put something together that we'd be really proud to bring to this legislative body. What we're dealing with is kind of a long process, and I'll go ahead and talk to you about the amendment that's coming in just a moment, but I do want to talk about how we actually got to the table. So obviously, thank you to Representative Sanchez. I also want to thank all of the stakeholders that have worked so tirelessly with us to get here. DOJ, Department of Human Services, Oregon Judicial Department, and the Oregon District Attorney's Association have all come to the table over the course of the last month and a half, and some of them longer ago, to get to a point where DOJ actually, and I'm going to quote Aaron Knott, and I think that'll make everyone happy, but he said that they unequivocally support the amendment that Rep. Sanchez and Senator Gelser worked on yesterday, and that they're... It was a 100% unequivocal, right. And so DOJ is absolutely in support, and we worked with Joanne Southey, who's the appellate attorney over there, who deals specifically with dependency issues. DHS, OJD, ODAA, they were all present at the table in drafting the language. The bulk of the bill that remains is mirrored after a Washington state law. And the purpose of having all these people at the table, they're all incredibly necessary to how this plays out, and have an inside look on how this plays out. I also want to point out all of the coalition members who have been stepping side by side with us on this. That includes the Coalition of Communities of Color, NIA, Partnership for Safety and Justice, YWCA of Portland, Children First of Oregon. We were happy to have our bill on their agenda, their legislative priority agenda, and ACLU of Oregon. One thing that I do want to know about the ACLU of Oregon's position is this piece of our bill that you're seeing today is exactly in line with their national best model policy, and that's a huge deal. Essentially, line by line, it's exactly what their model policy is. So ultimately, our bill had two parts, and the first was about strengthening warrantless removal statutes. I'm not going to go into what that is. We're going to work group that with Rep. Sanchez over the interim. All of our stakeholders are going to be at the table, and we're incredibly excited to work with them on that. So getting to why we're here, and I know you want to hear about it. So what we're doing is we've created a statute that creates a process to allow parental rights to be reinstated in very limited circumstances. What we're talking about here is probably 8 to 10 cases a year. Washington State has a very similar law that we've mirrored the bulk of our law after, or our proposal after, and this impacts 8 to 10 families a year. So incredibly small, but incredibly meaningful. And so when you have a dependency case, parental rights ultimately can be terminated in circumstances where the parent was unable to make it right, unable to ameliorate the conditions that brought their kids into care. We had a hearing in front of the House Judiciary Committee last week, and I know all of you probably don't have time, but I would very much encourage you to pick and choose some of the testimony that we presented last time. There's a woman named Kendra Wright who testified, and she's pretty much the exact person, exact situation that this bill is seeking to address. Kendra was in a situation where she was parenting her child went into care. She was depressed, she was doing drugs, and she ended up doing some significant amount of time for, I believe, property crimes in prison. Because she was unavailable to parent, her rights were terminated. The great-grandparents of her child, who I believe was 11 or so at the time, was ultimately adopted by those grandparents, those great-grandparents, and so they're much older. Kendra came out of prison and had ameliorated all of the concerns. In fact, she had another child, and the Department of Human Services wasn't involved in her life. She's a healthy, functioning citizen. And she had this other child that had been adopted by her family, and there's not that legal relationship. And so what we're trying to do is reach situations like that where we have a person who's able to parent. And I think it should be the policy of the state of Oregon that we want people who are ready, willing, and able to actually take care of their children to do that. And so in Kendra's situation, this is what we're trying to address. As far as the amendments that we've worked on, I want to talk a little bit about kind of what the bill actually does and what the amendments are that we've gotten. So there are a lot of safeguards in the actual bill. And so the safeguards I want to talk about have everything to do with who can file and what is a court looking at and what kind of circumstances would a court actually be able to reinstate someone's rights. So only the Department of Human Services and the child can file. Some states allow the parent to file, but we agreed that instead of having a parent file, it made the most sense to have the department or the child do that. The child must be at least 12 years of age to file this motion to get in front of the court. The child has a right to have a lawyer appointed, and so we believe that's incredibly important. The child, during this process, is still a ward of the state. The child must consent to her parents' rights being reinstated. So this is part of the amendment that Rep. Sanchez and Senator Gelser worked on yesterday. The reason why this matters is we want the child to be able to have a voice separate from that of their parents, separate from that of their caregivers, and we believe that it makes incredible sense for a judge to literally be able to sit and talk to a child and find out whether that person actually wants their parents' rights reinstated. Another piece that is incredibly important is we do not want a child to
interrupt with a question.
Oh, of course.
Really quickly.
Absolutely.
So on the issue, and I think this is really important, mm-hmm. It's in the base bill that came over that only the department and the child can make the motion. I think many of us that have been doing this for a while, it's not unusual to receive many letters from a family where they aren't going to fit the circumstances of meeting these criteria to be reinstated, but we may receive many of those letters. We may receive communications from the the biological child saying, have this person stop contacting me. This would, because of the protections that you built in, there is no way in this bill that child is going to have these repeated contacts that they are trying to not have, because you anticipated that and built that into the bill.
And Senator Gelser, that's exactly right. So one of the other pieces of the bill, besides the fact that the child has to consent, is also that the child, the department is not obligated, no one's obligated to tell the child if the parent wants to have their rights reinstated. This is solely a child-centered and agency-centered situation. And in practice, it would be incredibly destabilizing if every time a parent wanted to be reunited with their child, even if they didn't meet these really high standards that we set, it would be destabilizing for that child to get that type of contact. So the way that we've framed this is in order to protect kids so that they're not getting these unwanted contacts. The type of situation that this is actually going to come up in the 8 to 10 cases that we've seen, the type of fact pattern, is going to be where the parents, the children, and the agency are already still in contact. Maybe mom has come out of prison, or dad is able to parent again safely, and they're spending weekends with their child. They just don't have that legal relationship. And so really what we're trying to do is reestablish that legal relationship. And let me go ahead and pull up really quick one other document that outlines very specifically the amendments, because I understand that we're pressed for time, and so I want to make sure that I'm getting everything important on the record. Okay, and so I'm going to put all of the amendments that Senator Gelser and Representative Sanchez worked on together, and then I'll explain the rest of the safeguards. So the first amendment, or this first piece of the amendment, is when a motion is filed, all of the parties have to have notice, and we purposely included, if the child's an Indian child, then the tribe has to be included in that notice, and we think that that's incredibly important. I know that Rep. Sanchez had spoken to multiple people who had requested that. The second piece is what we started to talk about, that the board should not be told that a parent just at any old time wants rights reinstated, because we don't want to destabilize the child. The board should get to consent to reinstatement regardless of age. We did have an age requirement in that previously. And then this is actually a really big piece, and this is something that we think is incredibly important. Currently, the way that the bill is proposed, when a motion is filed, first off, only the child and the agency can do that. The standard is incredibly high. So beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest standard. That's criminal law. The next highest standard in civil world is clear and convincing evidence. That's the standard that we've picked. It's something incredibly high, where the person filing the motion has to show that the parents have ameliorated the concerns that originally brought the kid into care, that the kiddo wants to go back and they're consenting to that, the court also has to consider best interests. And so best interests is actually a very common set of standards used in family law and used in criminal law. And it's not a new concept. And so essentially what that is the court has to consider the child's health, their safety, the need for permanency meaning, are they going to have what's the rest of their life going to look like? What's their situation going to look like? Their age, their maturity, their ability to express their preferences. And then the amendment that Senator Gelser and Representative Sanchez worked on is to include language that also says not only does the court look at best interests, but the court also has to look at the parents' rights, why the parents' rights were terminated in the first place. And so that's important, because we want the court to have eyes wide open about why the rights were terminated. Was there abuse? Was it drug addiction? Was it criminal activity? Was there domestic violence in the home? Have these things actually been ameliorated? Are these things that can actually be ameliorated? And so that's up for the court to decide, and this very high standard, has that been met? The second part that we've added is why the parent wants her rights reinstated. And so this opens up and broadens the relevancy of information, so the court can actually look at the parent and say, hey, why are you here? Why do you want to be back with your child? And the concept here behind this is we want to protect children from parents who have less than stellar motivations. I believe in these circumstances, the type of situation that's going to arise, the parents are going to be acting in good faith, and they want to be with their kids, and the kids are going to want to be with their family. But we thought it was important to include that in order to protect kids. And then also, the third piece that is part of this new amendment is, what's the impact of, if there was any past abuse, regardless of what kind of abuse that was, we want the court to consider what's the impact of that on the child. And so this purposely opens up what the court's going to consider. Was there abuse, and what does that look like? That's incredibly important because when you step back, we need to remember that the court's looking at the totality of the circumstances. And this is the juvenile court judge that most likely dealt with the whole dependency case. This is a person who has seen this family and probably multiple generations of this family come before them in court. And so this is a person who is in a position that that we give discretion to, that we ask to make these types of decisions all of the time. To make this kind of determination. And so we want them to look at every single avenue, and that's why that piece of the amendment is so important. And so I think that I've outlined all of that. I want to make sure that, are there any questions on that piece regarding the amendment? So in interest of time, I've included written testimony from my organization, but I've also included a one-pager that talks about safeguards. And so it's bullet point by bullet point as far as, like, what is the actual process and how is that protective. And I think that if you have time to read any document today, please read that one. So I guess ultimately, we're asking for you, once we get this amendment, and we know that we'll probably be back in front of you, hopefully for a work session in the next few days, to take on the amendment that Senator Gelser and Representative Sanchez worked on. I'll make myself available if you have any further questions. Amy Miller with Oregon Public Defense Service, and then Angela Sherbo, who is essentially, she's probably watching, she's a kind of a lawyer legend in the dependency community, is available by phone today to speak to you. And so we'll go ahead and call her, and I guess bring Amy up, and I'll cede the floor.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Senator Gelser?
Yes.
Yeah. I would make a recommendation as soon as you or our administrator receives the amendment that you send it to the committee,
yes,
rather than, or post it to OLS, and then
absolutely,
let us know that it's on OLS right away so we aren't seeing it for the first time.
Absolutely.
When we come to committee. Thanks.
And again, that's why we got this here today. The bill came off the House floor yesterday afternoon. We submitted the amendment language last night, and it got referred to our committee this afternoon while we were on the floor. I would also mention, yesterday afternoon I had the opportunity to spend about 45 minutes with Judge Waller, and that was incredibly helpful. So if you're, you know, it brings up a lot of questions, but I felt really good after talking to Judge Waller just about this clear and convincing standard and what a judge would be considering and making a decision that's this monumental. So I would urge you, you know, call her or call the judges in your community sooner than later. Clearly the form of our juvenile bench is different from community to community. We have a different setup and the community that Representative Rayfield and I share, and I think we'll hear from him about that a little bit. But.
So thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Dan Rayfield, House District 16. First off, I just want to thank Representative Sanchez for actually having a good conversation with me. I came to this party extremely late in a short session when a bill had already passed out of committee, and then I started reading it. Because of my background in the human services area, I had some concerns also being in courtrooms and seeing how judges actually rule on things and how they interpret certain laws. And so this was one that kind of piqued my interests in terms of some sideboards that I think that could make it just a little bit more solid, because I think, quite frankly, the bill and quite frankly the amendments that both of you worked on make this a make me feel much better about the bill, frankly, internally. And I had a lot of internal trauma having to go to Representative Sanchez because I was like, oh, I know she really cares about this bill, and I have a couple of suggestions. And but what is a legislative session without a little conflict? What do you say? anyway, so with that said, let me tell you a little bit of the background, because I think termination of parental rights is something that's very significant for the child and for the parents involved, and quite frankly, for the community. The type of cases, you have a wide variety of cases and the situations that develop in a termination of parental rights. On one end, you might have a parent that just goes off the map and you don't know where they are, right? And they don't respond, right? And so under those circumstances, when they get their life back together, and if one of their children's is not adoptive care, it makes a lot of sense if they've met these standards to reunite them, because that's probably going to be in the best interests of the child. On the other end of the spectrum, some real examples of termination of parental rights are where a parent has put their hand in boiling water. Where the parent has taken cigarettes and extinguished them on the belly of a child, or in situations where there is sexual abuse, right? And there's other laws that kind of deal with that. So there's these other sides of cases where definitively we could sit there and say, okay, under those circumstances, from a public policy standpoint, it's probably not best for reunification under those circumstances. Under the current bill, what happens is a child, can instigate this process if they want to be reunited. And when that is done, an investigation then must take place, and that'll be flushed out a little bit later. So for two reasons, I think we could put some sideboards on here because of the way that is. Currently, you might not think that a child is going to want to be returned to their parent into some of these really egregious type situations. And in fact, there are many instances where because that parental bond is so strong, and even though these really traumatic events may not be in the best interest of the child, they still do want to return. And you can have professionals say that is probably not the best circumstance for them. So in crafting, with the Representative Sanchez being very gracious, he says, hey, why don't you just draft an amendment? Let's see what we got. And so I took a first stab at something which, quite frankly, there's some things in here that would absolutely need to be changed. But the idea being is there's a couple of exceptions. Number one, for the best interest of the child. The second one, for the for also the best use of state money. And so the first one is if there are a certain subset of type of person crimes or physical abuse that rises to a certain level on a child, they wouldn't be able to avail themselves of this process, right? So for instance, if you had severe physical abuse to a child, you wouldn't avail themselves. And part of the reason you want to put that sideboard is the four standards that were mentioned a little bit earlier, even though there is a clear and convincing proof, when you say the term ameliorate, which is the first standard, I have seen judges who can say, well, ameliorate, you served your prison term sentence. By clear and convincing evidence, you got through your criminal sentence. That means ameliorate, right? Because they can interpret that how they want to. And if there isn't, and right now under our current permanency laws, we continue to have cases going up to the appellate court, cases that people try and determine what some of these things actually standards are met. As you go further on down, the final one is fairly subjective, and you can have really strange outcomes. A real case that has gone on is where there was a parent who had an active urine analysis for positive for methamphetamine within the past week. A child was returned to that family. And you say, that's interesting. And that's because the way the laws are written, and each judge interprets those differently, even with a clear and convincing standard. So for me, public policy-wise, having just a couple of sideboards, and the amendment I crafted says actually person felonies and A person misdemeanors or A person class A misdemeanors, which I'm not necessarily supporting the misdemeanors, but I think there could be a sideboard number one right there that if that crime was committed on the child that was the subject of the removal by the parent, then you wouldn't be able to avail yourself of this position. The second thing is if there are certain circumstances, again, that we know a judge isn't going to return a child under those circumstances. So if you have pending felony charges against you or some other type of pending criminal charge, a judge is not likely going to return the child under those circumstances. However, if a child wants to go back, We're now going to waste state money on investigations and putting DHS, an already stressed agency, forcing to go through, and whether it's one of these or five of these a year, you know, that is something that, quite frankly, DHS is already struggling with in terms of their caseloads and things like that. So those were some of the ideas I think you could probably come up with. You know, this committee is a lot more immersed because the chair here is very immersed in this subject. You might be able to come with other, you know, different ways to craft at those ideals. I'm not stuck on anything, but I thought it was good at least to throw these considerations out for the committee for you to consider. The other thing to keep in mind is, though, even though you may only successfully get 8 or 9 of these cases a year, this could be invoked much more times than 8 or 9 times by a child or an individual. So the stress in the department, while probably won't be huge, it probably is going to be a little bit more than 8 or 9 cases.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, please. Representative
Rayfield. So one of the things that I've been working through in my head, I don't know if you've had a chance to, I think I sent over last night the language that we're working on in the other amendment. The parent, if we adopt the other amendment, the parent would never be able to initiate the action. And that was my concern there, was I'm 12 years old and I get this phone call that says, hey, you know, your mom wants you to come back. What do you say? And I think that puts a kid in a very difficult position. So we took that part out, that it's the child that is moving that, or the department that is moving that. Does the removal of the parent's ability to either make the filing or initiate the conversation by going forth to say, hey, I want to do this, let my kid know, does that help with these concerns about people that would inappropriately be doing that? Does that help at all with that concern?
Chair Gilzer, member of the committee, I do not believe it does. If you talk with folks on the ground level that are working with children in these situations, there are oftentimes children want to be put back into the situation with their parents in situations that all, you know, I feel pretty comfortable all of us in this room would say that's not in the best interest of the child. There, you know, and I could cite some pretty, you know, extreme examples. And so sometimes because a child wants to move back, right, which those are some of the positives of the bill, because it does require the court to consider what the child wants, but also some of the other factors, right? So the reason you need to have that in there is because what the child wants is not always what's in best interests of, you know, their well-being in the long term. And what I think, if you talk with some of the folks that are working, they can give you numerous examples. Each caseworker and each DHS department across Oregon can give you some really good examples of when what the child wants is not necessarily even what a judge would determine not going to be in their best interest. So I think having those additional protections make a lot of sense. And that's in the standards that are set forth in the fourth part of the standards to return the child. Again, depending on how a judge interprets that, that's what worries me. And what I can tell you is, as an attorney, you know, my job is to figure out what are the worst case scenarios that can happen, and then hopefully avoid those, you know, up front. And that's why I'm here today. Although I will say that the amendments that were both proposed considerably help alleviate some of my concerns. Although, you know, this is something that I do believe would strengthen the bill too.
And I have one other question about the word ameliorate. So I asked that question of Judge Waller yesterday, and what I hadn't thought about before, and I'm curious about your perspective or if others have things to add, is that the if this motion comes before the court or another juvenile court judge previously is going to have made the decision to terminate parental rights, which is a very difficult decision. It's a very high standard to get to that point. Mm-hmm. So the department or the child that is coming in to make this argument and make this motion, and since the department has to do the child can make the motion, but it also says that the department has to demonstrate that the parent has addressed the situation. The department is going to be in the position of sitting in the court and arguing exactly against what they had previously argued in the same court. So they will almost have to disprove the case that they had previously proved, which would so Judge Waller had suggested that would require
you know, psychological tests and a whole variety of other things to be able to demonstrate that, well, it feels better, it looks better, she says she wants to do it better, that wouldn't be enough because you'd have to have this clear and convincing standard that the judge would be loath to reinstate and overturn something that had previously happened, and the standard just by virtue of the department or DOJ who's representing them having to come in and argue the opposite of what they had argued a couple of years prior. Is your experience with the court similar to that?
So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that is one judge's reading of the law as, you know, as it is. I've heard others that read it differently. And so in terms of, you know, it going back, you might actually have a situation where DHS does not agree with the child. And so if the DHS does not agree with the child, in terms that that is what's in the best interest, the child is appointed an attorney, is my understanding under the, and so you could have DHS actually opposing what the child wants to do, unless that has been, unless I have misread that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Rayfield. So I've been practicing law since 2011, and four of those years was actually as a dependency lawyer, and I've represented hundreds of children in dependency cases. I've also represented parents. The firm that I worked for represented mostly kids, and so I do come at this from a relatively child-centric position. Regarding the child having an attorney, we purposely put in the bill, because the child's still a ward of the court and will likely already have an attorney, that if they decide that they want to file this motion, that they have an attorney at that point. Regarding kind of the question regarding, you know, would it be possible for the agency and the child to have differing perspectives? Yes. However, one of the safeguards in the bill is not everyone who wants to have a hearing gets a hearing. We've created a process where the filing party has to prove what's called a prima facie case. And so essentially a prima facie case means that the motion and the information that they submit with the motion has to sufficiently put on enough information that the court believes that there's going to be enough information to have that hearing. And so they have to actually be able to show through the information that they attach essentially to their motion that parents have actually ameliorated the conditions. I know Amy Miller is going to, with Oregon Public Defense Services, is going to come up here and talk, and she's been a dependency lawyer and an appellate lawyer in this section, and she'll probably be able to address what does amelioration actually mean. As far as kind of the child's wishes, I think one piece of information that I do want to leave you with is currently in the state of Oregon, in dependency cases, and even in juvenile delinquency cases, kids are prosecuted every single day in the state of Oregon and adjudicated on criminal charges. And we expect them to be able to make important decisions and have a confidential relationship with their attorney and make these decisions about what they want to do with themselves and their lives. Children who are of considered judgment, essentially meaning that they can articulate what they want, when they have an attorney, that attorney articulates that to the court. This is Joey. Joey's 13 years old. Joey says that he wants to go home. And so you go into court and you do say, Joey wants to go home. The judge still gets to determine whether or not that's in that kid's best interests in this bill. The court still gets to make that determination, but I don't want this committee to discount how important a child's wishes is. We're ultimately talking about someone's life and what they want to do with their life. The safeguards built in the standards that we've tried to build in are specifically in there to protect kids, but also make this a court process that would work for people who want to have some agency about what's happening with themselves. I very much thank you for the time that you've given us.
Representative Wagner.
Yeah, just one question, and hopefully I'm working off the right staff measure summary at the dash A5s. I don't know if I am, but I do have one question regarding, and it's my own ignorance not knowing this section of statute, but the 18 months since the termination of parental rights or 6 months since affirmation of the judgment is by an appellate court. Why the year and a half timeline for this? Why wouldn't it be something that you could move more expeditiously on?
Chair Gelser, Senator Wagner, so when we sat down at the table with the Department of Justice and Department of Human Services and Oregon Judicial Department, we were talking about what's the point of this bill? And the point of this bill is to get at the essentially teenagers who have blown out of placements or who have been adopted and given back or who are not able to find permanency, meaning no one wants to adopt them. We want to prevent teenagers from aging out of foster care. And so that timeline is to really narrow this to those types of cases because we're not trying to get in the way of cases where there are children who are finding permanency quickly. And statistically, 83% of adoptions happen within the first 17 months after a termination. And so if you think about it, babies and small children and kids who don't have developmental disabilities or behavioral problems who are easily adoptable are going to get adopted. What we really want this to focus on are the kids who, after that timeline's kind of passed, they're still kind of languishing. And so that's really why this is, there's that timeline, and that's why this is narrowed. And it was done intentionally, because we're not trying to get in the way of kind of the normal course. We're trying to prevent kids from aging out without having a legal relationship.
Actually, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I just want to really make sure that everybody understands, I think that this is a good bill, okay? I do believe, you know, I fundamentally believe that there should be sideboards. This committee and everybody in this building may disagree with me, and I'm entirely okay with that. But I want to respect the work that Representative Sanchez done, because she's done some amazing work. I think this committee does amazing work. I'm going to excuse myself so I don't further get you off of the most important things that you need to be talking about, which is passage of this bill.
Thank
so.
You.
Any other questions?
And I guess we did not hear about the thoughts about the amendment, the dash five. Yeah.
Chair Gelser. I understand the thought process around it. I understand certainly, you know, the idea that if someone has done something against the child, but I feel like we've addressed those issues in the current amendments that we had worked on. And we could possibly put some a little bit different than what Representative Rayfield offered, specific to if the crime were committed against the child, and that was the reason why a parent went to prison. I think that's absolutely valid. You know, worked in this field for many, many years, I do recognize that there are children who, despite what may have happened to them, they want to go home. That they, you know, may feel that connection so very deeply that that is the safest place for them. And we also know that that's an issue that kiddos suffer just because of ongoing trauma and issues with just trauma. But I don't think that that's what we're looking at. I think we have narrowed this in such a way to try to make sure that we were talking about kiddos in situations where they have moved from foster home to foster home to foster home and age out with 30, 40 plus placements in their time, which is not okay.
Right.
Where these kids have run away many, many times from foster homes just to return to the parent because that's what they felt like they needed to do. We're trying to get to a place where we're looking at just, again, a very narrow group of kiddos and families that could actually meet the criteria. So, and you know, I understand Representative Rayfield's concern also about the cost to the agency around this in terms of court time. But I think that overall we recognize that there's a huge cost to the agency every time we have to replace a child. And every time we have to go through a process of figuring out where this kid is, where are they going next, and then when this child then transfers to the Oregon Youth Authority system because other things have occurred in their life because they're so frustrated and angry. And many of you know my concerns about the fact that we continue to support then the Department of Corrections with kiddos who've been through the child welfare system over and over again. This is a rugged situation here, and again, we're just trying to address just a few families, a few kiddos that actually can safely return home and put into place some things that will make that work.
Thank you. Are there other questions before we hear from Amy?
So,
Thank you, Senator Gelter, and members of the committee. I'm Amy Miller with Office of Public Defense Services, and my role at OPDS, I'm currently the acting deputy director, but normally I oversee trial-level representation in juvenile cases. My background is doing this work before I worked at OPDS, and I think Mary and both representatives did a good job of talking about the bill. There's a piece of it that they didn't cover, and I want to make I think I can provide a little practical perspective here, and that is what happens when the court restores parental rights, right? What happens? Does the kid just walk out of the courtroom that day arm in arm with the parent? The answer to that in this bill is no, right? What happens when the rights are restored is that the child remains a ward of the juvenile court. So all that happens is their rights are restored. That is a huge deal. But the child is a ward of the court, and the parent is as well a party to the case. And so what will happen is that DHS would then be providing services to the parent, to the child. They would be overseeing any sort of case planning that would happen to reunify the family. In fact, the bill says that DHS is required to make rules around how they're going to handle that. In addition, what would need to happen is a permanency hearing would need to happen within 60 days of the restatement of parental rights. And that's because the case plan for the child was probably either adoption or it might have been permanent foster, another plan, permanent living arrangement, permanent foster care, or it may have been something else. But the point of it is the court would need to decide then that the plan would need to be to reunify the child with the parent and would need to make that legal decision. And so I just wanted to be clear that, you know, if the court were to restore parental rights, that is a huge hurdle, right, toward putting a family back together, but it's not the be-all, end-all, right? There's an entire court process. There's services that need to be provided. There's a reunification plan that needs to take place. And so I think it's important for you to know that. And the proponents of the bill, I think, worked hard to make sure that those safeguards were addressed. And the other thing I just wanted to comment on, just based on my experience and hearing Representative Rayfield's comments, is that to the extent that you can, flexibility for the juvenile court and for the agency is important. I say all the time, you can't make this up. You know, you work with these families, and you can never forecast all of the different iterations and things that could happen. And I was thinking about, you know, absolute sidebars, and, you know, I respect certainly that perspective. But, you know, thinking through what's in the Dash 5, for example, you know, when a child is very young, a parent could have exposed the child to a place where drugs are manufactured, right? The parent could have then been charged and convicted of endangering the welfare of a minor, which is a Class A misdemeanor. That child, for whatever reason, could have bounced around in a number of foster homes. The parent's rights could have been terminated, and it could be 10 years later. And you're looking at whether or not it might be appropriate at that time to reinstate parental rights or not. But if you put an absolute bar, you would never have that opportunity. So I think it's important to be flexible to the extent that you can, because families come in all shapes and sizes and iterations over time. People heal and grow and change. And I think that's it. I just wanted to make sure you kind of understood the longer-term consequences. If there's any other questions I can answer, I'm happy to do that.
Amy, I'm sorry. I just want to clarify for the record.
Pull the microphone over.
I'm so sorry. Chair Gelser, the circumstance that you were talking about would be if it was possession, not manufacture.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yes, that's honestly a more common scenario. Yep. So someone had, you know, some kind of drug paraphernalia in a sock drawer, and then they're charged with reckless endangering.
And I do think I heard him say that, you know, this was the amendment he just got back. He wasn't as committed to the to the misdemeanor. I think when Representative Rayfield spoke with me yesterday, his concerns were much more explicit: physical abuse, sexual abuse, where there had been injury to the child. And I think his language around that particular child and the idea of, you know, people change and grow and could be phenomenal parents to another child, and that's kind of where we came up with this language in the other amendment. What is that impact on that relationship? I think just for me, fundamentally, it's hard for me to imagine as a public policy that we would take an individual that had been the victim of a violent crime and put them back with the person that had victimized them, which does not preclude the restoration of that person, but whatever the intentions or growth of the person that did that action, the victim still had that experience. And I know there's a lot of different perspectives on that, but that's where he's not here anymore, but I don't think I don't think he was suggesting possession. And that's where it gets difficult, is how do you describe these things precisely and blah. Yeah. Senator Montesinger, it looked like you had a question or a comment.
No, I'm getting a little confused as to the amendment that Rayfield was proposing. it's different than the one that you have.
That's right.
And since it's causing so much, you know, there's some ambiguity or, anyway, I'm concerned that, are you thinking that you want to move that? Because I have, I'm not sure I'm ready.
Correct. So the plan is not to move this today. The plan is to come back.
No, I meant that amendment. Are you very interested in?
In Representative Rayfield's amendment? No, I said I would put that out here for all of you to consider. It's a conversation that came up late. We have this other amendment that's coming. There are a couple of ways at addressing the issue. So,
just to clarify, that's still in LC. Language hasn't been ironed out yet. It's still redlined or some such thing, and we haven't seen a copy. It's not ready, quote, ready yet. It hasn't been published.
You have Representative Rayfield's amendment. That's the A5.
Right,
the other
correct.
Amendment should be
There's
turned around quickly.
One,
and I will send to all of you tonight just what we sent to Legislative Council so that you
great.
Have that. It's actually not a particularly complex
amendment.
I think amendment.
There's like two sentences.
Two complex sentences.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
It's T-O-O complex.
Yeah. Oh, Senator Lindicum. Jokes.
Anything further?
And Angela Sherbo, Chair Gelser, she was going to make herself available by phone. She is a content expert. We might have dealt with it, but if you do have questions, I know she'd make herself available to you personally.
And I think any of your judges or others in the area might be helpful, and certainly the folks. Thank you, Representative Sanchez, for working so hard on this and for jumping so quickly to come over on, I think, less than 2 hours notice. Great job getting everybody here. And we'll make sure everybody has that amendment when it comes back. I don't know that we have anything else that is getting assigned to this committee, but if we do, it will be scheduled for a hearing and work session on Tuesday, because that is our last day at this rodeo. So is there anybody else? And don't leave yet, because we've got to go back and vote on that other bill. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 4009? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4009. I'm going to carry over the work session for House Bill 4009 to next Tuesday. Is that alive? We've done what we need to do? Okay. The boss in the back said we're okay. And I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 4134. And where we are at is we have a motion on the floor to adopt or to send it to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
None whatsoever.
Is there any opposition to this measure? Seeing none, it goes to the floor, and Senator Frederick will be the carrier. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4134, and we carried 4009 over. We carried 4009 over. Yes, it's over. Okay. And we will adjourn for the day. I just didn't want